Come on in, find a seat. My name's Ryan. I want to welcome you. Well, I situate my mic pack here. I want to welcome you to week 5 out of our series from the book of Acts called This Is Us. This week we're going to be in Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 7. And I'm pleased to announce what I like doing with preaching generally is the Bible says that all scripture is given by inspiration of God, and it's profitable for 4 things: doctrine, reproof, correction, instruction, and righteousness, and it's profitable for making us complete and thoroughly equipped for every good work. In other words, when you understand what this book has to say completely, it's not given to us for information, it's given to us for transformation. It should help you live better. It should translate to action in your life, which is, it should improve the quality of your life. It should help you skillfully navigate some of the most difficult situations in life. That's really what this book is meant to do. And that's what I want to do today. Because today we're going to talk about something that I promise you have gone through. In all likelihood, you are going through it right now. And if by some miracle that's not the case, then I am certain you're going to deal with it very, very soon. Maybe as early as later today. I've heard it said that there's 2 things promised in life. What are they? Death and taxes. I don't think that is, we're not talking about taxes, by the way, and we're actually not talking about death. I don't think that that's a wrong statement. I do, however, believe that it is an incomplete statement, because I believe, and I don't think anybody's going to argue with me on this, I believe that there are 3 things promised in life: death, taxes, and what we're going to talk about today, which is conflict. In 30 short minutes, you will have no more conflict for the rest of your life. How exciting. What a great Sunday for you to join us. We experience conflict in every relationship we have, including our relationship with ourselves. Pops up in our marriages, in our families, with our friends. Pops up in our relationship. I mean, you read the psalm, and you're reading, so often it's a psalm of lament. And what it is, it's David experiencing conflict in his relationship with God. Of course we have conflict with God. And we have conflict in ourselves. I mean, Paul in Romans 6 or 7, he's talking about this inward battle. He sounds like he's lost his mind, but he hasn't. He's just being honest. He's saying, man, I do what I don't want to do. I don't do what I want to do. Who's going to save me from this, spiritual schizophrenia that I'm dealing with? Everybody who's being honest with themselves can relate to that. That's internal conflict. And the way that we handle conflict has a profound impact on our lives. Like, all of us know people who conflict has really been a fork in the road in their life. And conflict can cripple you. It can leave you sort of a shriveled husk of who you could have otherwise been. Or, looking back, conflict can be, it can be the catalyst for unbelievable growth, health, development, refinement in your life. So how we deal with conflict, really, a lot hinges on that. And thankfully, what we're looking at this morning is really a roadmap. It's just a real short story. It's a real important story. And it's a roadmap for how you and I should understand and handle conflict. Because in Acts chapter 6, verse 1 through 7, what we're reading is the first recorded conflict in the group of people known as the early church. And so what we'll see based on what we read is really how we should understand conflict as far as where it comes from and how we should think about it. We'll see how we should understand it, how we should handle it, and what happens if we handle it well. And so, if you have ever had a problem, have a problem, or ever will have a problem, today's text is for you. So we're going to get started in Acts chapter 6, and I just want to read the first verse because there's a lot there. It says, "In those days, as the number of the disciples was multiplying, there arose a complaint," imagine that, "by the Hellenistic Jews against the Hebraic Jews that their widows were being overlooked in the daily distribution." Right from there, we're going to go to our first idea this morning. It's that community creates conflict. What you're seeing here is the church grew, which is awesome. But as people got closer to each other in community, conflict arose. And to be perfectly honest with you, I'll just start here. I find this story incredibly refreshing. I find this story incredibly encouraging, because what this story proves more than anything else is that the people that we read about in the Bible were just that. They're people. And a lot of times what I've noticed is we have a tendency to project our assumptions onto the men and women that we read about in this story, and a lot of times we can pretend as though they weren't really like us. They weren't really dealing with our kind of half-hearted nature. You know, they can't really sympathize with our fears, failures, insecurities, weaknesses, the whole nine, when really nothing can be further from the truth. The story of the Bible is not the story of really good people working their way to God. It's the story of a really good God working his way to really bad people. And you see it time and time again as you just mouse through the stories in the Bible. For instance, you take the story of Noah, and what you have on paper is a man who was so, you know, courageous. He cared so little about what other people thought of him and so much about what God thought of him that he built this gigantic boat, even when the Bible says that it never even rained. And God's telling him, hey, water's going to fall out of the sky. There's going to be this flood. You're going to build this boat, and it's going to save your life. Without asking any questions, Noah just picked up a hammer, started swinging. And however many months or years later, he's got this big boat. Then he's got the trust in God to step into this thing, believing that God's going to see him through this ordeal so that he can live to walk on dry ground again. It's an incredible story. But if you read the story to the end, what you'll also read is that after the flood, Noah plants this vineyard, harvests himself some grapes, gets hammered drunk, and makes a fool of himself in front of his kids. And I find that refreshing. To be honest. And here's why. Because I have two kids, my son's going to be four this month, and I've already made a fool of myself more than a few times in front of them. And I'm pretty confident it's going to happen more than a few times again before they move on out the house and want nothing to do with me anymore. And so when I read the story about how God can use a man that I can sympathize with his weaknesses, it encourages me. It's refreshing to me. You see the same thing in the story of Abraham. Abraham's the story of a man who, you know, imagine at 75 years old, God appears to him and he leaves everything behind for the sake of God. Hebrews says he didn't even know where he was going. He just heard God say, go, so he started moving. At 75 years old. Now, these were the golden years of his life. This is when he's meant to run out the clock in peace because the Bible said he had it made. But he had money, he had camels, he had servants. I'm sure he had servants who had camels. He probably had camels who had servants. Had it all. That joke killed at the 9 a.m. too. I was eagerly waiting to see how that would land. Two for two. No, but he had it all, and then he walked away from all of it for the sake of God. And if that's all that I read in that story, if that's all the Bible told us about Abraham, that doesn't do me any good because I don't have perfect faith. I can look in my life and see doubts that I still struggle with, fears that I still struggle with, anxiety that I still wrestle with. I think one of the biggest issues in my life is just this ongoing tension where I foolishly want to believe that I'm better at taking care of myself than God is. So the thought of leaving everything behind and just banking my entire life on the fact that he loves me more and is better at caring for me than I even could be at myself, man, that's a weighty thing. I sympathize a lot more with the father of a sick son in Mark chapter 9, who called out to Jesus and said, Jesus, I believe, but I need you to help my unbelief. I need you to meet me in my weakness, even when my faith isn't perfect. That resonates with me. And so if all I read in the story of Abraham is that you need to have perfect faith in order to be used by God, well then, count me out. The only thing that leaves me with is the painful realization, hey, maybe I don't belong in God's family. Maybe he can't use somebody like me. But if you hold a microscope to the life of Abraham, all through the second half of Genesis 12, you read not once but twice his faith was not so perfect. And not once but twice, purely out of fear, he started telling people that his wife, who was evidently real good looking, was his sister. And he allowed men who he was afraid of to take his wife from him without saying a word. I mean, you want to talk about cowardice. And I've read that before, and I've wondered, how on earth did Abraham ever look his wife in the eye ever again after that? But despite his weakness, God still used him. And you could do this with every single story of every single man and woman that God used throughout the pages of the book we call the Bible. He's not waiting for perfect people. He's waiting for people to realize that they need a perfect God. And so if you've been following this series up to Acts chapter 6, it's easy to get into this mindset where we start believing that these were just super people. Right? Like so far up to this point, all we've seen is the gospel explode on the scene, and people are getting saved by the thousands every turn of the page, it seems like, and there's perfect unity and this unbridled generosity, and you know, they're being persecuted, but they respond with boldness and dependency on God. And it's easy to read that and start thinking, well, maybe the early church was just perfect, and nobody, it's never going to be like that again. But stories like this prove that wrong. Stories like this prove that the people in the early church were just that. They were people. And where people are, conflict's sure to follow. And the conflict that had taken place in the church in this particular scenario arose between two groups of people. You have on one side, you have in one corner the Hebraic Jews, and then in the other corner you got the Hellenistic Jews. And Hebraic Jews were very traditional. They would have probably been considered, you know, really conservative. They held to the old ways prescribed by their fathers in the Old Testament. They primarily spoke Aramaic. Hellenistic Jews were just the opposite, because they had been scattered throughout the ancient world, and so they were heavily influenced by the ancient cultures of the ancient world. And so they had a different way of thinking, a different way of eating, a different way of dressing, a different way of speaking, just a different way of life. And the differences between the two of them are probably comparable to like conservatives and liberals. They're two very different groups of people. And the conflict in this particular scenario centered around one thing. It was that Hebraic widows were being taken care of very well by the early church, whereas Hellenistic widows were not. And a conflict of this magnitude could have easily completely derailed the church before it ever really got off the ground and out of Jerusalem and begun doing what Jesus designed it to do. Now, before we look at how they handled it and what we should learn there, I just want to make a really important observation about conflict that we see in this story, namely that conflict is not always necessarily the result of wrongdoing. Meaning, it's not as though in every conflict somebody's right and somebody's wrong. And the reason I say that is because in this story, the Bible never even hints that the apostles did anything wrong here, that they intentionally overlooked anybody. And kind of on the other side of the conflict, you know, the Hellenistic people, they weren't being too sensitive. It's not like they had unrealistic expectations. The atmosphere in which this conflict was born is because you had two very different groups of people coming together. And more often than not, that's where conflict comes from. Right? That's why marriage is so difficult. Every time I do a wedding, and I don't really have any idea whether or not this is, you know, goes over well, but every single time I do a wedding and I stand on the altar and, you know, in front of the beaming young couple ready to take their next step through life together, I always say that marriage would be the easiest thing in the world except for the fact that it involves two people. And because it involves two people, you have two different people who come from different childhoods, they have different expectations, they have different types of emotional baggage, some they're aware of, most of it they're probably not aware of yet. And it's the bulk of the conflict in marriage comes to bear not necessarily always because somebody's right and somebody's wrong, but because two people are very different from one another. And the reason I say that, that's really what happened here. But the reason that I highlight that is because a lot of times people experience conflict and they kind of lose their minds and they see conflict as a cause for, you know, cutting ties and uprooting and trying to start over somewhere else. And so what a lot of people will do is they experience conflict in their marriage or in their family or in their church, and that's it for them. And so they uproot and they try to start over somewhere else, and they just wind up bouncing from place to place and relationship to relationship, all with this unspoken idea that eventually they're going to arrive in this relationship or in this group of people where there will be no conflict. And hey, that's a delightful thought, but it's not in keeping with reality. Because as long as God allows there to be people, there will be conflict in our relationships. And it's not always black and white as this person's right and this person's wrong. Sometimes it's just people are different. And so not only is conflict not necessarily a cause to just uproot in and of itself, but actually what you see in this story is that the conflict we experience can be a catalyst for incredible growth in our lives, growth that would only be possible if we experience conflict. The only trouble is that because we're fallen people, we're dealing with sin natures and our own insecurities and whatnot, we just have this proclivity to handle it so poorly. And so before we look at how the church handled this, what I want to do is highlight two ways that pretty much two equally wrong ways that people handle conflict, and I'll make a bold statement before I get into this. I can promise that everybody here, generally speaking, leans toward one of these camps. Nobody argued with me at the end of the 9 a.m., so maybe I'm onto something here. There's two equally wrong ways of dealing with conflict that I'm willing to bet everybody here falls into one of those camps. And if you don't know which one you fall into, just ask somebody who knows you, okay? The first wrong way to handle conflict is what I affectionately refer to as the ostrich defense. One of the ways that we know God has a sense of humor is because he created something called an ostrich. And if you know anything about ostriches, the way that they deal with threats, with uncertainty, with any anxiety-producing situation, anything that remotely resembles conflict, is they bury their head in the dirt, laboring under the delusion that if they can't see it and they don't address it, it'll just go away on its own, which I believe has been the death of many an ostrich. And I was still 9 a.m. It's kind of amazing that ostriches are even still around. Like, we're not seeing ostrich skeletons in a museum somewhere. But a lot of people go through life like that. A lot of people employ that in their relationships. And so the moment that anything that remotely resembles conflict rears its ugly head, they do the same exact thing. With the same exact assumption that if I don't talk about it, if I don't address it, if I don't confront it, it's just going to go away on its own. And what happens when you go through life that way is issues inevitably become problems. And problems inevitably become emergencies. And emergencies will inevitably become catastrophes. And a whole lot of people are going to get hurt, very simply because of your passivity and your unwillingness to confront somebody as uncomfortable as that would have made you on the front end. That's one wrong way to handle conflict. The other wrong way to handle it is to go exactly the opposite way, which is instead of to underreact, you overreact to conflict. And I was telling the 9 a.m., what's funny is when you look at a married couple, you usually have one person from each camp represented in the marriage. I actually don't know an exception to that. It's just funny how one person is pretty even keel and runs the risk of passivity. The other one is not even keel and runs the risk of a heart attack when they're 40. I'm that person in my marriage. So when the opposite mistake that people make here is sort of letting every conflict completely throw you off kilter and rock your world and steal your focus. And what happens is, you experience this exhaustion as you're constantly going through life trying to put out fires because of whatever conflict you can find. The reason that that doesn't work is because no matter what we do, there's always going to be conflict in our lives. And if we allow that to dominate us, well, then what we become is victims to our circumstances, who are constantly reacting to our circumstances and never really moving in any direction, let alone the direction that God has called us to move in. And what you see with the apostles here is that they found a healthy medium right between these two extremes. So here's what you read in verse 2. It says, "Then the 12 summoned the whole company of the disciples, and they said, 'It would not be right for us to give up preaching about God to handle financial matters.'" So what the apostles did is they knew that this situation could easily split the church apart if they didn't address it, so they called everybody together to address it. However, they had a calling on their life. They knew that Jesus had called them to lead this church, not to get consumed with the day-to-day affairs of this church. They had to spend the bulk of their time in prayer, listening to God, and preaching, speaking for God, and so they didn't allow this conflict to derail their lives. So next we see with what happened, what we see is how the very first major conflict was put to rest in the early church and what we can learn from it. In verse 3, it says, here was their decision. It says, "Therefore, brothers, select from among you 7 men of good reputation, full of the Spirit and wisdom, whom we can appoint to this duty. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the preaching ministry." The proposal pleased the whole company, so they chose Stephen, a man full of faith in the Holy Spirit, and Philip, Prochorus, Nicanor, Timon, Parmenas, and Nicolaus, no chance I got those right, a proselyte from Antioch. Verse 6, "Then they had them stand before the apostles, who prayed and laid their hands on them." This is our second idea this morning, and it's really the main idea of this passage. It's that contribution corrects conflict. What you see here is the apostles knew that this needed to be addressed, so they immediately went to the congregation. The church was, a couple thousand strong, maybe as many as 10 or 15,000 strong at this point. And so they said, "Listen, Present seven people that you know have a good reputation. And once the church did that, the apostles confirmed that calling. They laid hands on them publicly to confer, you know, the responsibility and authority on them in order to carry out the task that they have been handed. But the most amazing thing about this story, and I think this is the most important detail of the story, is that of the seven men that are mentioned, every single one of them has a Greek name. If you've been here any length of time, I know you've heard me say this before, but there is no such thing as needless detail in the Bible. God's not trying to meet a word count by some professor. If it's in here, it's because we needed to see it. And this story could have just as easily said, so seven people were chosen, and that's the end of the story, but it didn't. It tells us each of their names, and it shows us that all seven of these men had Greek names. Now, the reason that that is so significant is because it was the Greek-speaking community in the church that were angry. And frankly, it was the Greek-speaking community in the church that had a really good reason to be angry. All right, try to hop in their shoes for a minute. So imagine if you're a part of a church and it was only your widowed mother who consistently got neglected, and only your friends' widowed mothers who consistently got neglected. All the people who look like you and talk like you and live like you, all of your widowed moms never get their needs met, but the people on the other side of the cultural barrier, well, I mean, they're fat and happy. I'll just be honest with you. I don't care whether that's a misunderstanding, intentional or not. I would be fired up. And if you had an issue like this that was, you know, based around culture and racially driven, if you had an issue like that in about 11 out of 10 churches today, what you would see is a church split. I say that because churches split over the dumbest things in the world. Churches split over whether or not they like the carpet. They split over whether or not we should have a guitar or a piano on the stage, how loud the music is, how dim the lights are. Christians find reasons to divide in the culture that we live in. And if these people had done that, here's what would have happened. You'd have a church split, and on one side of the street, you'd have the first Greek Church of God, and right on the other side of the street, the first Hebrew Church of God, and they'd be driving into worship services every Sunday, giving each other the stink eye and keying each other's cars, right? And they've been so incensed fighting with each other and locking horns and preaching sermons about how that other church is full of heretics that they would have completely forgot about the people outside the four walls of the church that need to hear about Jesus. Which is what happens in way too many churches today. But instead of any of that nonsense, what we see here is that seven men who were offended and had every right to be, seven men who were overlooked, who were neglected, who were treated wrongly, intentionally or otherwise, seven men who could have decided to stay angry decided that wasn't good enough for them. And even though they had been wrong, they decided they were going to roll up their sleeves, they were going to put in the work, they were going to meet this need and fix this issue. And that's how God's people are called to handle conflict. We don't stand on the sidelines and complain about the issue. We contribute to the solution. Because bottom line, every conflict that's ever been resolved has only been resolved because somebody chose to contribute rather than complain. And I'll tell you something you already know that you're probably going to hate hearing as much as I hate saying it. But that conflict in your marriage will not get resolved by you articulately explaining to your wife how she was wrong and you were right. Might win the argument, but you will not settle the conflict. That gridlocked relationship with you and your son or daughter is not going to ease up by you sitting down and telling them how short-sighted they are and how stupid they are and how they're not thinking about their future enough and how they need to rely on you, and they can't be trusted because they're so irresponsible. That is not going to solve the conflict. And even in your interpersonal life, you got baggage that you're carrying around, you got, you know, habits that have turned into maybe addictions, things that are taking hold in your life, and man, those things don't go away by you complaining about how hard they are. They go away by you deciding finally to do something about it. This story in Acts chapter 6, verse 1 through 7, what it is at its essence, it's the very first picture of conflict resolution that we have in this group of people known as the church. And what we see as clear as day here is that one of the distinguishing marks of God's people is that in times of conflict, they distinguish themselves by contributing rather than simply complaining. And that is not the way that the rest of the world does things. And it's I know you know what I'm talking about. All you have to do is watch the news. I remember a couple of years ago, we had these riots in Baltimore. Everybody remember that? I mean, literally the city was on fire. And what you see on the news or in politics or whatever, every time something like that happens, here's what always happens. One person stands in front of a camera on behalf of Team A, and another person stands in front of a camera on behalf of Team B. And all they do is argue about who's really to blame. Right, and so Team A says, man, these people are just irresponsible, and this is due to the breakdown of the family system, and they need to take personal responsibility and pull themselves up by the bootstraps. And then Team B says, no, it's the fault of the leadership, because they've failed to provide opportunities for people that are disadvantaged to better themselves and to, you know, grow and get out of these endless systems of poverty and oppression. And they go back and forth about where the blame ultimately should rest. Meanwhile, there's still a fire that needs to be put out. And what I admire about the early church is they didn't play that game, because it would have been so easy. I mean, think about it. The apostles so easily could have held whatever their version of a press conference was and say, hey, everybody just cool down. It's not easy being in leadership. We're not trying to do anything wrong here. Jesus never told us that, you know, that things like this were going to happen, and we're just misunderstood, and you people have unrealistic expectations. They could have completely justified themselves and blame shifted, right? Which is a professional skill that it seems like a lot of politicians have mastered today. I'm just saying. The people on the ground, right, these Greek-speaking Hellenistic Jews, they could have just ran a smear campaign and said, man, those apostles talk a good game about loving God and loving people, but they don't love us. They don't love people that look different than them, that have come from a different culture than them. They could have, you know, split the thing apart and tried to assassinate their character, but nobody did that. And in the example that we're seeing here, what we're seeing is that there comes a time when we need to stop arguing about who's at fault and just recognize, hey, the fire's still burning. Somebody's got to put it out. How about that? Because it's real easy to stand on the outside of issues and speculate about where the criticism belongs, right? Just like it's real easy to stand on the outside of somebody's life and speculate about all the stupid things they did that got them into the situation that they're in. It's real easy to live that way because it requires no effort, requires no skill, and it requires no character. It's the easiest way to go through life, but it's not God's way. If you just think about the story of the Bible, what you read, this whole account from start to finish, is the story of a God who refused to stand on the outside of our problems. Thank God. Because what God could have done and what he would have been completely justified in doing is just staying up in heaven and providing a running commentary on the stupidity of mankind, which he'd still be writing because we give him more than enough material. Right? He could have looked down and said, man, mankind's problem is that they consistently put their wants and needs above the wants and the needs of their neighbor. He could have said, mankind's problem is that they are so slow to extend grace when they've been wrong, but they are so quick to expect it when they do wrong. He could have said, man, mankind's biggest problem is they find all these stupid reasons to divide even when there's so many better reasons to unite. But instead of doing any of that, Jesus came down here. He lived among us. He taught us. He loved us. He went to the cross for us. And what Jesus did at Calvary is what we see at Calvary. It's the ultimate contribution in history that settled the ultimate conflict in history. Because what Jesus has done is once and for all settle the conflict between God and man. And now anybody who wants to have peace with God can have peace with God simply by surrendering their life to Jesus. But what we see in our Savior is that he refused to stand on the outside of issues even when they weren't his issues to solve. Even when the fault rested 100% with us, still he refused to stand on the outside of our lives. He instead contributed, and that's what he's called us to do as men and women who claim to follow in his footsteps. And so before I leave this point, I just want to bring this home to where we live, and let me just ask you, what would it look like the next time that conflict rears its ugly head in your life? If instead of asking who is wrong, you asked, what can I do to make it right? What would that look like in your marriage? Or in your family? Or in any of the relationships with people that God's allowed you to maintain? If the very first thought that came to your mind is, what can I contribute to this issue to put it to rest? What we see in the final verse of this story is exactly what God can do when people think and live that way. Because in verse 7, here's what we read. It says, so the preaching about God flourished. The number of the disciples in Jerusalem multiplied greatly, and a large group of priests became obedient to the faith. And this is our third and our last idea this morning. It's that increase can come from conflict. I'm so convinced, I've seen it in my life, you've probably seen it in your life, that so often we allow conflict to sabotage us or to paralyze us, when so often conflict can be the catalyst by which just the opposite happens. And God can do incredible things in and through us by that conflict. And what you read in the final verse of this story is that something that could have completely ripped the church apart instead caused the church to see unprecedented health, growth, and effectiveness. And it's because these people refused to handle conflict the way that our instincts would have us naturally handle it. And three specific things happened as a result of what they did. Number one, it says that the preaching about God flourished. It says that the disciples in Jerusalem multiplied greatly. But thirdly, and I think this is so cool, it says that a great number of priests became obedient to the faith. And the reason I think that last tidbit is so significant is because at this point in the church's history, they didn't have a building that they met in. So they got up in the temple complex right alongside the priestly system. And so these priests that you're reading about in verse 7, they had a behind-the-scenes look at the church. They got to see how these people handle conflict. And I'm convinced the reason that they became obedient to Jesus is because they saw that the followers of Jesus handled conflict in a way that wasn't like the rest of the world. They didn't cut and run on each other. They weren't at each other's throats. There was no smear campaigns. There was no justifying and finger-pointing and name-calling and any of that. And because these people, these priests, saw how followers of Jesus allowed their relationship with Jesus to impact how they go through conflict with one another, that, more than anything else, caused those priests to see that there really is something different about Christianity and to know that a relationship with Jesus really is viable. And after this episode, what you read is that the church explodes beyond Jerusalem into Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. But none of that would have happened if these people had taken the easy way out. And what that should tell you and us today is that whatever conflict we find ourselves in, at work, in our marriage, with our kids, with our friends, in our interpersonal life, that conflict, as painful as it is, as exhausting as it is, as much as we would rather not go through seasons like that, that conflict can be the catalyst through which God does amazing things in and through us. Because we have no idea who we're ministering to as we go through conflict the right way. We have no idea how many people we're preaching a sermon to as we go through conflict as contributors rather than complainers. And so what we're going to do to end the service today is during this last song, you're going to be invited to come up and take communion. And when you take the bread and the juice, remember that what we're celebrating with communion is the reality that Jesus was a contributor. That instead of standing on the outside of our lives, he got involved. And because Jesus did what he did, the conflict between God and man can come to rest. And now we, sinners, can actually find peace with God. And while we're taking communion, we're also going to have the elders up on either side of this table. And I tell you, if you're here today and you're in the midst of a very painful conflict in your life, and you know that God's calling you to go about it in a different way, we just want to invite you during this final song to come up and talk to these elders for prayer or whatever it is that you need. But I'll leave you with this. If Acts 6, 1 through 7 shows us one thing and one thing only, what it shows us is that God can do incredibly powerful things in the midst of incredibly difficult situations when people stop asking who's wrong and start asking, how can I make it right? That's it. That's all.